All right, I want to pick your brain for just a minute. You're in a room with an all southern exposure, and a bear walks by the room. What color is the bear? I'll give you just a second to answer that. And of course, if you do answer, you got to understand this is on the radio, so I won't be able to hear you, but you're welcome to talk to yourself. All right, here's your answer. The only place this would be possible would be at the North Pole. You know, all southern exposure, which means the bear is a polar bear. Therefore, the answer is white. All right, I got one more for you. All right, I got one more. So you're driving a bus, right? Actually, that sounded more like semi than bus, but you get the idea. You're driving a bus, right? Your choice, be Coach USA, it can be Greyhound, Dartmouth Coach, whatever, it doesn't matter. There are 10 people on the bus. This is going to be like one of those math problems that you absolutely hated in grade school. There are 10 people on the bus. First stop, 2 people get on, and 4 people get off. At the next stop, 3 people get on, and 4 people get off. At the next stop, nobody gets on, and 2 people get off. Now, what's the name of the bus driver? It's you, silly, if you haven't figured that out yet. It's you. Most of us probably like a good riddle every now and then. We don't want to go through that every day because it would get old, but every now and then they can be kind of fun. It can be fun to tease your brain. And there are a few brain-teasing riddles in the Bible. Believe it or not, you wouldn't think that the Bible is a place you would go to find a good riddle to tell somebody. But there are some in there. And perhaps the most common one is the one that we find in Judges chapter 14. And yes, if you're thinking, isn't that the silly little riddle that Samson proposed to some people? Yes, you would be absolutely right. Good job. Judges chapter 14. In verse 12 through 18, he's going to get us kickstarted today. Samson said to them, now the them there is referring to the 30 young men who the bride's parents had selected to be Samson's companions. Apparently it was like a wedding custom sort of thing, whatever. So the them there are these 30 men. Samson said to them, let me tell you a riddle. Now, what possessed him to do this? I don't know, except that, let's face it, Samson was kind of reckless. He wasn't exactly the Noah of his day, okay? It's not like Samson was this great guy of character and spirituality, okay? He really was reckless and irresponsible. He had a nasty temper. He didn't really seem to think before he acted, which could be the reason why his life was so complicated. And yet God was still able to use him to accomplish his purpose, which we're going to talk more about that as we go. But the reason for this riddle, frankly, in my opinion, is simply because Samson was just that kind of a reckless, careless individual. Now, the riddle itself, really not a problem. Why he had to essentially attach the bet to it, you know, I'll give you this if you can't figure it out, but if you do figure it out, then I'll give you this. Why he went that far, again, Samson's a little bit reckless. So this idea for this riddle gets in Samson's head. Let me tell you a riddle. If you solve my riddle during these 7 days of the celebration, I will give you 30 fine linen robes and 30 sets of festive clothing. But if you can't solve it, then you must give me 30 fine linen robes and 30 sets of festive clothing. All right, they agreed. Let's hear your riddle. So he said, out of the one who eats came something to eat. Out of the strong came something sweet. Now, if you're wondering, where did that riddle come from? As you may recall, backing up to verse 8, he killed a lion a little bit before. And in verse 8, he returned to Timnah for the wedding. He turned off the path to look at the carcass of the lion. He found that a swarm of bees had made some honey in the carcass. He scooped some of the honey into his hands and ate it along the way. So that's where it's coming from. 3 days later, they were still trying to figure out the riddle. On the fourth day, they said to Samson's wife, entice your husband to explain the riddle for us, or we will burn down your father's house with you in it. That seems like bad sportsmanship and kind of being sore losers, but, you know, I guess it takes all kinds, but it still seems pretty extreme to me. Did you invite us to this party just to make us poor? So Samson's wife came to him in tears and said, you don't love me. You hate me. You've given my people a riddle, but you haven't told me the answer. Honey, I haven't even given the answer to my father or mother, he replied. Why should I tell you? All right, I threw the honey in there, okay? That's not in the New Living Translation that I'm reading, and I doubt that it's in the original Hebrew either. But I'm imagining the tone that might have been going on here, right? I haven't even given the answer to my father and mother. I haven't even told mom and pop, okay, sweetheart? Why would I tell you? So she cried whenever she was with him and kept it up for the rest of the celebration. At last, on the seventh day, he told her the answer because she was tormenting him with her nagging. Then she explained the riddle to the young men. So before sunset of the seventh day, the men of the town came to Samson with their answer. What is sweeter than honey? What is stronger than a lion? Samson replied, "If you hadn't plowed with my heifer, you wouldn't have solved my riddle." Now, I would imagine that Delilah would not have been pleased being referred to as a heifer. I know my wife would certainly not be happy with me if I did that, but maybe she never found out. A lot of people will spend hours trying to figure out the spiritual meaning of this riddle. It's in the Bible. There must be some spiritual point to be made here, but what is it? Because I don't get it. It lacks the subtle clues like we had with the riddle of the bus driver. If you listen closely, you can hear that you are the bus driver. Or even in our opening riddle, if you listen closely, it's an all-Southern exposure, which, when you think about it for a little bit, kind of helps clue you in. But there's really no such clue here. What point was God trying to make by having Samson propose this silly riddle? Because I missed it entirely. Well, you can't miss what isn't there. There is no point that God is trying to make with this riddle. It simply is just a silly little riddle. Now, that doesn't mean, though, that it isn't significant. It's just that the significance is found in the totality of the story and not in just the riddle itself. Verse 4 of the same chapter says that this was from the Lord, for he was seeking an opportunity to act against the Philistines. I think it's fair to say that the riddle is part of this greater plan. If Samson had fallen for one of the women of his country, he would not have had an occasion to be traveling back down to Timnah. He would not have encountered the lion, which was his foundation for the riddle, which he told to the Philistines, who solved the riddle in less than honest and pleasing methods, which sends Samson down to retrieve the 30 sets of clothes. And the story progresses even more from there, with his wife being given to his best man, so Samson gets revenge because of that, which sets off another string of events, all which eventually lead to the final event in his life when he kills more Philistines at his death than he ever had in his life. But this riddle by itself contains no real spiritual message that we can see. By itself, it was just a riddle Samson gave as a means of entertaining guests, albeit, I think, as foolish as it was. But Samson was being used by God to give the Israelites relief from the oppression of the Philistines. Now, that does not mean that God approved of Samson, necessarily. He was not supposed to be marrying a Philistine woman. That was absolutely forbidden. He was a Nazirite. He was not supposed to touch the carcass of the lion the way that he did. But Samson really didn't seem to care about any of that stuff. Again, he was careless, he was reckless, he was irresponsible. He didn't think about the consequences of his actions. So again, it's not like Samson was the Noah of his day, right? But that didn't mean that God couldn't use him. See, this is where God differs a whole lot from us. See, because we would let a lot of those things limit us. But God isn't limited by many of the same things that we are. And so God was still able to use Samson to accomplish his purpose. That didn't mean that God was putting his stamp of approval on Samson's life and saying, "Nah, there's no problem. If you want to marry the Philistine, go ahead. I realize that I forbid it, but, you know, I'll back off of that." No, this is not God giving a stamp of approval on Samson's life. But it is the fact that God is not limited by human ignorance, by human rebellion, by human stupidity, by human carelessness, which is a good thing because there is a whole lot of that in this world. Unfortunately, there's even some of it in the lives of the Christians. Fortunately, God isn't limited by that. Now, Samson may not have understood what was going on, but God in his majesty understood the situation from the time Samson fell for the woman, encountered the lion, proposed this riddle, and all the way through to his very final moments. Samson had some issues. Absolutely. He was attracted to forbidden women. He had a nasty temper, but God can accomplish his purposes with just about anybody. And he did that through Samson. Samson's riddle by itself is not spiritually significant. It's simply just a riddle. However, when considered along with the totality of the Samson/Israelite story, it takes on a greater importance. And behind this riddle, you see a God who still controls everything, who wasn't limited by any of the human ridiculousness. He's still able to control everything. And I want that phrase to be a lead into our next riddle, because in this next one, we're going to see that even the riddle itself is of vital importance. This one is proposed by God, who is not careless, who is not reckless, who is not foolish. So there actually might be some spiritual significance to this one. And there is. Without this riddle, the story of mankind would have ended far differently. But again, you see a God who still controls everything in spite of human behavior. And this one takes us over to Ezekiel, chapter 17. And we have got 18 to start with. We've got 18 verses to read here. So bear with me. Stay patient. Stay awake. Grab yourself a cup of coffee, whatever you want to do. Ezekiel chapter 17 and verse number 1. Then this message came to me from the Lord. See, I told you that the Lord himself proposed this riddle. You didn't believe me, but I tried to tell you. Son of man, give this riddle and tell this story to the people of Israel. Give them this message from the sovereign Lord. A great eagle with broad wings and long feathers, covered with many colored plumage, came to Lebanon. He seized the top of a cedar tree and plucked off its highest branch. He carried it away to a city filled with merchants. He planted it in a city of traders. He also took a seedling from the land and planted it in fertile soil. He placed it beside a broad river where it could grow like a willow tree. It took root there and grew into a low spreading vine. Its branches turned up toward the eagle, and its roots grew down into the ground. It produced strong branches and put out shoots. But then another great eagle came with broad wings and full plumage. So the vine now sent its roots and branches toward him for water, even though it was already planted in good soil and had plenty of water, so it could grow into a splendid vine and produce rich leaves and luscious fruit. So now the sovereign Lord asks, will this vine grow and prosper? No, I will pull it up, roots and all. I will cut off its root and let its leaves wither and die. I will pull it up easily without a strong arm or a large army. But when the vine is transplanted, will it thrive? No, it will wither away when the east wind blows against it. It will die in the same good soil where it had grown so well. Now, to be fair, perhaps maybe riddle isn't the right word to use for this, because riddles are, you know, supposed to be kind of short and sweet like the ones we've looked at here. This could actually probably be more of a parable, but I called it a riddle because it has a bit of a riddle element to it, because initially when you're hearing it, you're probably not automatically figuring out, oh yeah, that's exactly what he's talking about. So there is a little bit of a riddle element to this, but to be fair, it is probably more of a parable. But verse 11, then this message came to me from the Lord. Say to these rebels of Israel, don't you understand the meaning of this riddle of the eagles? And besides that, right there, the New Living Translation calls it a riddle. So I think I'm off the hook. The king of Babylon came to Jerusalem, took away her king and princes, and brought them to Babylon. He made a treaty with a member of the royal family and forced him to take an oath of loyalty. He also exiled Israel's most influential leaders, so Israel would not become strong again in revolt. Only by keeping her treaty with Babylon could Israel survive. Nevertheless, this man of Israel's royal family rebelled against Babylon, sending ambassadors to Egypt to request a great army and many horses. Can Israel break her sworn treaties like that and get away with it? No, for as surely as I live, says the sovereign Lord, the king of Israel will die in Babylon, the land of the king who put him in power and whose treaty he disregarded and broke. Pharaoh and all his mighty army will fail to help Israel when the king of Babylon lays siege to Jerusalem again and destroys many lives. For the king of Israel disregarded his treaty and broke it after swearing to obey. Therefore, he will not escape. Now here's a riddle, / parable, symbolizing King Zedekiah's ambivalent royal policy, which led to his demise. Nebuchadnezzar laid siege to Jerusalem in 597 BC and took its king Jehoiakim, also known as Jeconiah, captive and left in Jerusalem only the poorest of the land. And he appointed Mattaniah, Jehoiakim's uncle, to be king, changing his name to Zedekiah. The two of them reached an agreement which basically stated that Zedekiah would be loyal to Nebuchadnezzar and in return would have the favor of Nebuchadnezzar, but the real control would be from Nebuchadnezzar, not Zedekiah. Now, it should be noted that this was not when the kingdom of Judah officially fell into captivity and Jerusalem was destroyed. This was approximately 11 years before those events. Zedekiah appealed to Egypt for military assistance, which was in direct rebellion of Nebuchadnezzar and direct conflict of this treaty. Now he's about to see what kingdom he has disappear, and he himself is going to die as a prisoner in the kingdom of the one against whom he has just rebelled. This would be when the rest of Jerusalem is taken captive and is destroyed approximately 586, 585 BC. Now, in verse 19, the riddle takes a curious turn. So this is what the Sovereign Lord says, "As surely as I live, I will punish him for breaking my covenant and disregarding the solemn oath he made in my name. I will throw my net over him and capture him in my snare. I will bring him to Babylon and put him on trial for this treason against me, and all his best warriors will be killed in battle, and those who survive will be scattered to the four winds. Then you will know that I, the Lord, have spoken." Zedekiah would most likely have sworn faithfulness to the agreement in the name of the Lord, probably with language somewhat similar to this: "May the Lord slay me if I do not remain true to this agreement." Now, you say something like that, you would think that you have absolutely no intention whatsoever of breaking such an agreement. Okay, that's a little bit more than just saying, "Yeah, I promise." Okay, actually, that's a lot more than saying, "I promise." To swear such an oath and then turn around and violate it was to treat God as if he were powerless. Starting here in verse 19, God has taken this breach of promise very seriously and very personal. And really not because he feels bad for Nebuchadnezzar. All right, God's angry. God is taking this personal because it was personal to him. It was personal against him, not just Nebuchadnezzar. All right, God feels betrayed. Now, that doesn't put Zedekiah in a very good position. And God basically tells him that, "Hey, you once thought that Nebuchadnezzar could be a problem. Guess what, Your Highness? I'm your problem now." And Zedekiah was taken prisoner, forced to watch his sons slaughtered in front of him, and then his own eyes were gouged out, making the murder of his sons the last thing he ever saw. And he himself was a prisoner until the day he died, all because he rebelled against Nebuchadnezzar. He had a way for his kingdom, what small bit there was, to have peace, but he rejected it. It then takes another curious turn in verse 22. "This is what the Sovereign Lord says, I will take a branch from the top of a tall cedar, and I will plant it on the top of Israel's highest mountain. It will become a majestic cedar, sending forth its branches and producing seed. Birds of every sort will nest in it, finding shelter in the shade of its branches. And all the trees will know that it is I, the Lord, who cuts the tall tree down and makes the short tree grow tall. It is I who makes the green tree wither and gives the dead tree new life. I, the Lord, have spoken, and I will do what I said." Here, the same imagery that was just used to refer to the negatives of their history is now being used in the positive, a glimpse into the Messiah of brighter days and a brighter future. This promise had its fulfillment in part with Zerubbabel, when he was raised up to lead the Jews in their return out of captivity and to rebuild the city and the temple, but it would have its full accomplishment in the kingdom of Jesus, the Messiah. He was sent to gather the lost sheep of the house of Israel and to be the king of a kingdom not of this world that got its start right there in Jerusalem. And the rest, as they say, is history. Our history. This kingdom of the Messiah was open to all, Jews and Gentiles alike, where all who call on the name of the Lord will be saved, without regard for race or color or family genealogy or analytical genius or sins. All who call on the name of the Lord will be saved and given a brand new, fresh start, where sins of scarlet are washed as white as snow. The promises that God made to his people, he was merciful to still keep, even though they had been unfaithful to him. The rebellion and captivity of the nation could have been the end of it all, and God would have had every right, because they broke their part of the covenant with him, but he still chose to keep his promise and restore them. The nation of God's people would continue, and today we know these people as Christians, as the Church of Almighty God and His Son, Jesus Christ. You may say, "No, wait a minute, those people are the Jews." Not anymore, my friends. That does not mean that they are excluded. That just means that it is not exclusive only to them. Friends, it is for everybody now. Jew and Gentile alike. And yes, I left a lot of details out of that summary, but I left the most important details in, that God kept his promise when he didn't have to, and God still has a people. Jesus came into this world in a very quiet and primitive way, and started his kingdom without a lot of flags and trumpets and ceremony. And yet this kingdom has reached literally all the way around the world, and wherever it reaches, it finds people who are sick and tired and in need of some kind of hope for their lives because everything they've ever loved, they've lost. It finds people who are poor and thirsty, weak with temptation or burden, and it invites them in. Come to me, all you who labor and are heavily burdened, and I will give you rest. In keeping his promise to God's people of old, he was keeping his promise to you, to me, God's people of today. He was looking forward thousands of years and was determined that you would not be left without a God, that you would not be left without that higher power and that higher authority to guide your life, that you would not be left without the highest love ever possible. Imagine a greater love than the love that comes from God, the Creator. You can't. There isn't one, because there is no one higher. And for centuries, he has been drawing people to himself and taking them into the shade of his care and grace, affording them a place of refuge from the turmoil and confusion of the world, affording them a solution to the problems they have created in their lives. And he has done this through Jesus Christ and the church that he has established to be his voice and the feet that carry his message. And may each local church in each local city take that responsibility seriously and never pervert it with their own ideas or their own preferences or their own agendas. Friends, just stick to the Bible. May the voice of God in the world today, his church, speak only the words of God and nothing more. We all have opinions about everything, and you know what? That's fine. But if it's opinion, we market it as such, but we keep most of them to ourselves. And if we don't know, we simply say so. But if it is God's truth, may we speak it loudly and boldly, and may we always remember that God said it would be the words that he spoke that would judge people. Not the intelligent sounding opinions of the Christians or the bylaws that the church comes up with that they want to run their church by. So we would do well and right to keep those out of our official doctrine and standards by which we expect our parishioners to live. And may the feet that carry his message never walk over those who are hesitant or timid or who disagree with the message that they carry, but rather walk alongside of them, willing to teach, but willing to ask questions and willing to learn something themselves of what they might want to call the other side. And by the way, walking alongside of them does not mean that we uphold all of the elements of their faith. And I'm talking about doctrinal differences, differences in faith between one church in the community over another. Walking alongside of them and working with them doesn't mean that we uphold all the elements of their faith. It doesn't mean that we, you know, agree with all of their elements. But it does show to the world that we do not close ourselves off from those who do not believe as we do. It shows the world that we are about humanity and helping and being a friend to those in our community, even if that community doesn't see eye to eye with us. Because Jesus walked the road to Golgotha, where he laid himself down on an old rugged cross, and as they raised it up and dropped it into the ground, his arms were open wide, drawing them all unto him. That's why this riddle is so important. Because it doesn't end with the rebellion of Zedekiah and the end of God's people as a people. It ends with victory in Jesus Christ. I, the Lord, have spoken and will do it. When God says something, it is as good as done, regardless of when exactly he said he was going to do it. And he did it. You and I are living proof of that. We didn't really need Samson's riddle to start out this message, but I used it because it's kind of a fun riddle, and I haven't given Samson any attention in quite a while, and I didn't want him to start feeling left out, so I put him front and center today. But his riddle does remind us that there is no limit to the power of God. Remember that everything Samson did, he did only because God gave him the strength to do it. Even if God chose a physical means, which he did through Samson's hair, it was still coming from God. And even though the riddle itself may seem pretty small and insignificant, and in many respects it is, but when considered with the totality of the story, it starts to take on a more prominent role. And remember that God is still in control even today. The same God who gave Samson his strength is the same God that we have today. The same God who proposed this riddle in Ezekiel to his people is the same God that we have today. There is no insignificant thing or an insignificant person to him. He can accomplish his purpose through all of them. We were his purpose from the beginning, and no rebellious king was going to change that. No conquest by an enemy nation was going to change that. No person like Samson, reckless and irresponsible and just didn't care about what was right and wrong, even he wasn't going to change that. As he looked at Nebuchadnezzar and Jehoiakim and Zedekiah, he also looked beyond them to the Son of God, laying himself down and then raising himself high and drawing all men unto himself. Life can feel like a riddle sometimes, especially a riddle we can't figure out the answer to. But I hope that we have learned from these two riddles today that God understands them, and in fact, the riddle was probably his idea in the first place. By themselves, the riddles of our lives may not make any sense. They're frustrating. Like the Philistines did in our opening verses, we could spend a great amount of time trying to figure them out, but we only leave tired and angry. But if we consider for a moment the majesty and supremacy of God, which we've already seen in these riddles, then we can spend more time resting in the knowledge that God hasn't lost control of anything. The riddles of our life may not seem very significant at the time. They're only incredibly annoying and trying and frustrating. But the riddle, in the totality of our story, has great significance. Friends, so let God write your story.